From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
Small cases, big silence at the U.S. Supreme Court. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. The U.S. Supreme Court began its latest session with a thunderous silence, not even explaining why it refused to consider same-sex marriage. The court may be off to a quiet start, but it's famously divided, and legal thinkers aren't ruling out the prospect of big noise before the term is all over. The justices will decide cases about religious beards and headscarves, violent speech on the internet, and discrimination in voting. At least one potential blockbuster waits in the wings, a case that could essentially scuttle Obamacare. Today's talking point, presidential politics and personal scandal. First, here's the news.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To the Point. After yesterday's opening session, U.S. Supreme Court observers were talking about the cases it won't take up more than those it's accepted. But today, the justices heard arguments in a case involving religious freedom. We'll hear what's on the rest of the agenda and ask, whatever happened to same-sex marriage? Today's talking point, Gary Hart's presidential campaign, was abruptly scuttled by reports of an extramarital affair. Was 1987 the beginning of a new age in political journalism? First, this story. Turkish President Erdogan warned today that ISIS is about to take over Kobani. That's a town on Turkey's border with Syria. He called for a ground operation to defeat the so-called Islamic State, saying bombs dropped by the U.S.-led coalition are not enough. Catherine James is a freelance reporter writing for Britain's Guardian newspaper. She's been reporting from the Turkish side of the border with Syria. Catherine James, welcome to our program.
Hi.
I understand that from the Turkish side, you can look across and actually see Kobani. What's going on there?
Well, yeah, that's right. Kobani, the town of Kobani, is on a hill that is directly opposite another hill in Turkey, and it's quite visible. You can see the shelling coming from the ISIS artillery, and you can even hear the cracks of gunfire from time to time.
What about black flags? I understand that ISIS has managed to raise some in the town.
That's right. Yesterday afternoon, we saw a couple of black flags go up just on the outskirts of the city, one on a building and one on a small hill to the east of the city. And at the time, they had not taken the city. They're not within the city, but obviously they are staking their claim already on what they think is theirs.
What have you heard from people who have left the town and tried to cross into Turkey?
People leaving are obviously quite distressed. It's a place that's their home. And many of them even come back and watch the shelling with us, among the crowds on the hillside. And it's fairly emotional experience for them. And some of them even have stories of what they've seen as they came from different villages around the town throughout the countryside of Kobani. And some of them were quite horrific stories of beheadings of family, of friends, and other kind of mutilation of bodies. But by and large, most of them are just really, really sad that they've been forced out of their homes and they have no idea what the future holds.
Now, this is a Kurdish town, and apparently that's the reason that President Erdogan has previously been reluctant to send troops there. Now he's calling for them. How do you explain that?
I think the president of Turkey is in a difficult position that, despite the fact we can see the city and we can see what's happening, in the end it's ultimately Syrian territory. So it is difficult for Turkey to simply send army personnel or tanks or to fire on across the border, because it's clear that would be seen as an act of aggression. And I understand the president of Syria has said it would be an act of aggression on Turkey's part. And ISIS has also made it clear that if Turkey intervenes, then they will also keep Turkey in their sights. So it's not that simple for Turkey to intervene. What the Kurdish people have been calling for is for Turkey to supply them with weapons, to send weapons to the people of Kobani so they can fight. Because at the moment they're clearly outgunned. They don't have the heavy artillery that ISIS has.
What are the chances of getting arms from Turkey? And is the fact that he doesn't want to give them arms the reason that President Erdogan is calling for somebody else to send soldiers?
It's a tricky question. I mean, the Turkey's been fighting a war with the Kurdish resistance here in Turkey for the last 30 years. So, and obviously that group is closely aligned with the group that are fighting in Kobani at the moment. So for Turkey to start supplying weapons across the border to the Syrian Kurdish resistance, it's far more complicated in that they've labelled the PKK, the Turkish Kurdish resistance, and the Syrian resistance a terrorist group. And so I'm not really sure what the president's comments were referring to today. We were all a bit surprised because it has been going for more than 3 weeks now. And for him to now be calling for more action and saying airstrikes are not enough, it actually baffles me a bit why he's only starting to say that now.
Does it appear to be too late? Is the town really already taken by ISIS?
I think given that ISIS yesterday were on the outskirts and from what we understand today, they are inside the city. I don't want to say it's too late. Is that, you know, I can't predict the future, but I think it is a bit late to start calling for action. Yes.
Very complicated situation, obviously, with the president of Syria, Mr. Assad, saying it would be an invasion of his country, even though he, too, is opposed to ISIS. Catherine James, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Freelance writer reporting from Turkey for The Guardian newspaper. In a moment, an uncertain beginning for the U.S. Supreme Court on To The Point.
Are you thinking about buying a new car? Consider donating your old one to KCRW and support the unique mix of news, music, and culture you love. You'll become a KCRW member and get a nice tax write-off. For details, visit kcrw.com/cars.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Warman Alney back with To The Point. At yesterday's opening session, the U.S. Supreme Court declined to take up cases involving same-sex marriage. Was that a surprise or not? We'll talk about that in a moment. First, today's arguments in the case of a notorious prisoner in Arkansas, a self-proclaimed Muslim jihadist who stabbed his ex-girlfriend. He says his religion requires him to wear a half-inch beard, contrary to the rules in state prison. Slate's senior editor, Dahlia Lithwick, was in the courtroom. Good as always to have you on our program.
Thank you for having me, Warren.
Tell us about the arguments.
I think it's fair to say that this did not go well for Arkansas and the Corrections Department. The justices, I would say, were pretty skeptical of the argument that a prisoner could have a quarter-inch beard if they had a medical condition, but not a half-inch beard, as Mr. Holt, the prisoner in this case, is requesting. It was a festival of silly at some points, lots of talk about people shoving SIM cards in their beards and tiny bits of razors and contraband, and even Justice Alito suggesting that you could have prisoners comb out their beards so the tiny little pistol could fall out. But it just seemed as though the court was pretty skeptical of Arkansas's argument that it's true 43 other jurisdictions around the country, all the other states almost, allow prisoners to have beards, but we are so, so different here in the Arkansas prison system that we need to keep our prisoners from having beards.
What about states' rights? The argument that a state has the option to treat its prisoners the way it wants to.
Well, there was a sort of discussion around the question of, it didn't come out as a states' rights question so much as, you know, this is a statute, it's called RLUIPA, and it's a religious freedom statute that is kind of a cousin to RFRA, the Religious Freedom Reformation Act, under which you remember Hobby Lobby and some of the other challenges. RLUIPA, the prison version of that, it's pretty much the same standard, except that while it says the prison has to have a compelling interest in corrections in order to limit religious freedom, it also allows for great deference to the prison staff when they say, we do have an interest here. One is meant to defer to them. So it puts the courts in a funny position where they're both supposed to apply strict scrutiny, the highest level of constitutional scrutiny. Nothing really gets by. But then they're also supposed to defer to the prison and say, well, you know, if you say you really can't have beards, we defer. So it's a little bit of a suck and blow posture right in the law itself. And so the court did press, Douglas Laycock, a prisoner at University of Virginia who represented Holt. They did press him on the idea that, look, we have to defer to the prison. If they say no beards, doesn't it have to end there?
I think you said Laycock was a prisoner in Virginia. I don't think you meant that.
No, I did not. I meant to say he's a professor at the law school at the University of Virginia.
Well, professors may regard themselves as prisoners from time to time. Who knows? You said two conservative justices, Scalia and Alito, made fun of this, a festival of silly, you called it. What about the liberals?
The liberals, I think, also had a hard time with the position that Arkansas was saying. I think that there was some feeling that, partly I think the problem that all of the court was having was that if we're going to have a fight today about the difference between quarter-inch beards that are allowed and half-inch beards that are not allowed, are you going to come back in 6 months and start asking about inch beards? At some point, the Chief Justice said, I don't want to litigate this, you know, inch by inch, and I don't want to get to the point where we're fighting about 1 1/4-inch beards. So what is the limiting principle here? That was one of the issues that was going on. But I think that the liberals generally felt that even though there are legitimate penological objectives to be met here, Arkansas just didn't meet its burden of saying 43 other states allow beards, but we're different. And they certainly tried to take the position that we're different because we send our maximum security prisoners outside to farms, we send them outside to do work. It's different from New York and California, where they can have beards because they're on a cell block. I just don't think the justices were buying it.
Okay. And, of course, with regard to Hobby Lobby, this was an individual asserting religious freedom, not a corporation, as was in the case in that situation. Is this representative of the kind of cases that the court has agreed to take as opposed to the sweeping case of same-sex marriage that was expected by many but not accepted yesterday?
I think that's a good question. And the mere fact that this case made it onto everybody's top 6 or 7 cases to watch tells you that, you know, not to in any way suggest this is a trivial case, but this is a case about one court that pretty much probably got it wrong, and the court will now reassert that prisoners have certain rights. And the cases that the court has taken, with the exception of the gay marriage cases, which they've now indicated they're not taking, are doctrinally interesting. There's a lot of interesting things in the pike, but do we have a blockbuster on the docket yet? Not even close.
Let me turn to Jonathan Adler, professor of law at Case Western Reserve University, a contributing editor to the Conservative National Review Online, also a contributor to the legal blog The Volokh Conspiracy. Good to have you with us.
Good to be here.
Are you surprised that the court didn't take up same-sex marriage?
I really wasn't that surprised. I don't think the court is all that eager to enter into this sort of issue unless it has to. The justices on the court that are likely to be sympathetic to gay marriage see lower courts moving in that direction, and justices that might be more skeptical probably aren't sure they have 5 votes to rule against gay marriage. And so it's hard to see, for me, what justices on the court would really want to take this issue right now.
So you weren't surprised then, and this is an instance, do you think, of the Chief Justice, perhaps, trying to avoid a controversy if one isn't necessary?
Well, it only takes 4 justices to take a case. So in this case, I just don't think that there were four justices. There may not have even been two or three that really wanted to wade into this issue. You have some justices that I think are perfectly happy to see lower courts move in this direction. You have an additional group of justices, probably including the Chief Justice, who are not overly eager to insert the court into contentious social debates like gay marriage. And as a result, I just don't think there are many justices that really want to address this issue unless they have to. And unless there's a circuit split, this is a question that they can at least for the time being avoid.
So the circuits don't disagree as yet. Dahlia Lithwick, back to you with Slate. You've indicated that you think this is a case of the court sort of leading from behind.
Well, I think that the court is in a funny position because a year and a half ago in 2013, they handed down the Windsor opinion. That was the big, big DOMA decision, Justice Kennedy writing for the majority.
DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act.
The provision of the Defense of Marriage Act that was under scrutiny was not constitutional. It was a very perplexing, I think, majority opinion. On the one hand, there was a lot of language of states' rights, and states have the right to determine for themselves what kind of marriage they would allow, but also a lot of sweeping language about dignity and respect for the individual. And so nobody quite knew what that case was going to stand for. But almost the day the ink was dry on that, we saw lower courts and now courts of appeals using that opinion to stand for the proposition that same-sex marriage bans are unconstitutional. We've seen it happen in 40 courts now. And the question for the U.S. Supreme Court is, does Windsor stand for what everybody thinks it stands for? And I completely agree with Professor Adler. I think that what happened yesterday was the court said, we're going to just let these cases pile up, and certainly we're going to wait until someone disagrees at the circuit court level that these bans are unconstitutional. We're just going to let Windsor stand for what it stands for right now in the eyes of the judges writing these cases and see how it all shakes out. So I do think it's interesting in that it was triggered by a Supreme Court decision that doesn't quite mean what all the lower courts think it means.
Okay, no blockbuster cases yet, but there is one on the horizon which might be accepted by the court in November, which has to do with Obamacare. And Professor Adler, you are given credit for having come up with an argument in this case that might have a major impact on Obamacare. Tell us about it.
Okay, well, the issue in this case is whether or not the federal government has the authority to provide tax credits for the purchase of qualifying health insurance in exchanges that were created by the federal government. The law that was passed envisioned a series of 50 state exchanges that would be created by states, and the law as written appears to only allow for tax credits in exchanges that states themselves establish. And I and some others have argued that that's what the plain text of the statute provides, and that if Congress doesn't like that, Congress needs to amend the law. The federal government has argued that the statute the language of the statute is sufficiently broad to give the IRS this degree of leeway. And it matters because 36 states chose not to create their own exchanges. So the tax credits for qualifying health insurance in those states is potentially dependent upon these rulings. And there's one cert petition pending from a case out of the Fourth Circuit where the IRS rule was upheld. Another federal appellate court in D.C. struck down the IRS rule, but that ruling is going to be reviewed by that court sitting en banc in December. And then there are two additional cases, both in district court, and in one of those cases, a district court judge struck down the IRS rule about a week and a half ago in Oklahoma. So the court could decide to take one of these cases in November. It could also decide to wait to see what other courts do with the issue.
Dahlia Lithwick, what would be the impact on Obamacare if, in fact, the court decided in the way that Professor Adler suggests it might?
Well, I think it'll be devastating in the states that don't have state exchanges, and that's part of the argument that's being used, for instance, in the Fourth Circuit. saying, you know, the impact of this is tremendous. But I think this is one of those cases that, you know, it's an incredibly interesting question. It comes down to a pretty narrow question of statutory, just the drafting of the statute and the language in the statute. But I do think that there was a feeling at the beginning of the summer when it looked as though there was a conflict between the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals and the Fourth Circuit. It looked like it was very, very much on the fast track for this term. Because the D.C. Circuit has put their own ruling on pause, they're going to hear it, the totality of the court. I think the chances are that it doesn't get heard this term. I think it's one for next term.
Let me introduce Adam Winkler. He's a constitutional law professor at UCLA and author of Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. Professor, good to have you on our program.
Oh, thanks for having me.
What do you think are the more important cases that we haven't as yet been able to have time for on this program?
Well, I think there's two big categories of important cases the court's going to deal with this year. One of those categories is what we might think of as election law cases, cases dealing with regulation of the political process. And the court has already accepted an important case on race-based districting. To what extent can Alabama concentrate minority voters in just a few legislative districts, making it a little bit harder for them to influence outcomes in other districts? The court has also accepted an important case out of Arizona on whether voters had the authority to grant the power to draw legislative districts for Congress in an independent commission rather than giving that power to the state legislature. There's some text in the Constitution that suggests maybe only the legislature can draw district lines, not an independent commission. And the court also has an important case with regards to judicial campaign contributions, whether judges can solicit those contributions in states where those judges are elected. Many states have ethical rules that bar judges from doing it. And then there's even more voting rights cases that the court might take out of Wisconsin and elsewhere. The second major category is discrimination cases, cases dealing with when can victims of discrimination make out a claim. And there's an important case that deals with Abercrombie and Fitch and whether a young girl who was applied for a job but wore a headscarf was denied a job because of that headscarf. And an important case dealing with fair housing law and whether the question is whether the court will require that discrimination in housing be proven only by intentional discrimination, or can a policy that just has a very broad disproportionate impact on minorities also amount to discrimination? So in these categories, there are some big cases, but they're not the high-profile cases that you might ordinarily associate with something like same-sex marriage.
Does the headscarf at Abercrombie & Fitch have the same connotation as the beard, half-inch, quarter-inch, no-beard in Arkansas and the prison?
Well, it's a different set of legal questions and a different there's a federal statute involved with the Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act in the Beard case, and the court generally is very deferential to prison guards when they claim security. This is not quite the same. This is in a private space, private employer that made some hiring or didn't, in this case, make hiring, possibly out of concern with religious accommodations. And so they are raised the similar issues of discrimination against Muslims, but in different legal contexts and raising very different legal questions.
And very quickly, if you can, what about pregnant workers in the case involving UPS?
That's right. Another important case dealing with discrimination. A woman named Peggy Young has sued UPS. She was pregnant and requested that she be given light work, light duty loads, on her doctor's recommendation. And UPS denied her that and said she couldn't have it. Now, UPS offers that same light duty load to some other categories of temporarily disabled workers, including those who are injured on the job, but denies it to other temporarily disabled workers, including pregnant women. The question is whether the UPS's decision to treat pregnant women like some other workers, but not like other workers, amounts to discrimination under the Pregnancy Discrimination Act.
Okay, we're going to take a very brief break. We'll come back. We'll continue to talk about the Supreme Court, what it's taking up, what it's not taking up. What about Chief Justice John Roberts, his 10th session? Is this, in fact, a definitive session for him? On our talking point, Gary Hart's presidential campaign was abruptly scuttled by reports of an extramarital affair. That was in 1987. Was that the beginning of a new age in political journalism? We'll talk with the writer Matt Bai. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
K KCRW's Eclectic 24 is our ever-expanding all-music stream, featuring the best new releases, classic favorites, and special features, including today's top tune, guest DJ project, and KCRW archives. Listen worldwide anytime online or through your iPhone or Android phone app. KCRW's Eclectic 24, where and when you want it. Check it out at kcrw.com/eclectic24.
We're not only back with To the Point. Once again, the Supreme Court is back in session, heard its first arguments today, a case involving religious freedom. Everybody seems to agree that having not accepted cases on same-sex marriage, a blockbuster decision is unlikely this term, but you never know. There might, in fact, be one with regard to Obamacare. In the meantime, what about Chief Justice John Roberts? Jonathan Adler, back to you at Case Western Reserve University and National Review Online. What do you think is the legacy of him, of the Chief Justice so far? Although he's a young man, he's in his 10th year.
He's in his 10th year. And one thing that was very noticeable about last term was the high percentage of cases that were unanimous in the judgment. It was the highest percentage of cases decided that way in about 70 years. It was really remarkable that a majority of cases, the justices were all agreed on what the ultimate outcome of the case should be. And that's even more remarkable because the court hears about half the number of cases that it did just about 25, 30 years ago. So it's only taking, as a general rule, the toughest, most difficult cases, the cases most likely to divide the court. And yet we've seen an increase in the percentage of unanimous cases. Now, this is something that the Chief Justice clearly indicated that he wanted to do as chief. And one of the real questions going forward will be whether or not last year was an aberration. Was this just a blip? Or does it indicate that he has been able to convince his colleagues that deciding more cases on narrow grounds where you can generate a larger majority or even unanimity is something that the court should do as an institution? And as we know, it's not always easy to do that. You have nine very strong-willed, very independent-minded folks. And you've been criticized on both the left and the right in various cases by justices that have disagreed with the course he's been trying to steer. And so this is something he wants as part of his legacy, and it'll be really interesting to see whether or not he's able to continue that trend.
Adam Winkler at UCLA, author of Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America, not relevant to our conversation at the moment, but you have suggested, given the fact that the court is divided 4-4 with one justice in the middle making the swing decisions, that one of the liberal justices, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, at the age of 80, ought to have retired before this session so she could be replaced by a Democrat rather than whoever might be successor to Barack Obama. She didn't do that. What do you think is going to be the impact?
Well, it's clear that she didn't do that and is not planning on doing it anytime soon. She's been basically going around the country doing interview after interview telling people she is not retiring. So I'm not going to be one to stand in her way. You know, the big implication is what this means in the 2016 presidential election. You know, if a Republican wins in 2016 and replaces Ruth Bader Ginsburg, then a court that is 5-4 leaning conservative but goes left on some issues will become 6-3 conservative, and all of a sudden Anthony Kennedy's swing vote becomes absolutely irrelevant. And I think we could see big, broad changes in constitutional doctrine were such a thing to happen, and changes that Ruth Bader Ginsburg would personally oppose and are in opposition to many of the things she spent much of her career fighting for. So I think it's a high-risk play, but I guess the way to look at it is you don't get to be you don't fight the fights that Ruth Bader Ginsburg fought against sexism and discrimination unless somehow deep inside you're an optimist and think things will work out for the best.
One of the cases where Ruth Bader Ginsburg was in the minority had to do with the Hobby Lobby case that we referred to earlier, having to do with corporate personhood. Kate Toomey is with us, partner at the law firm Lewis Bach in Washington, D.C., where she specializes in corporate law. And she's also represented Guantanamo detainees as well, which is where this issue comes into play. Kate Toomey, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Tell us about corporate personhood as opposed to personhood, if that's the appropriate distinction to make, and how it distinguishes the Roberts Court.
Well, I think that that the Roberts Court has certainly gone farther than any previous court in giving corporations rights which we would ordinarily ascribe just to what I'll call natural persons. And Hobby Lobby is one example, and Citizens United would be another one, the case in which the court considered and granted far-reaching contribution rights to corporations.
On the ground that spending money is speech.
Correct, and it's very interesting that of course these are First Amendment rights. They the court is clearly very interested in these First Amendment rights because, for instance, you know, it's a well-established principle of law that that corporations don't have Fifth Amendment rights. The right to the privilege against self-incrimination has long been held not to apply to artificial persons like corporations.
What if it did?
What if it did?
Yeah.
Well, then a lot of governmental investigations and prosecutions of corporations would look very different. Right now, a corporation can't tell an employee or a board member not to testify against the corporation. Those employees obviously may have their own criminal liability, but the corporation itself has no right to protect itself from criminal prosecution in that way, in a Fifth Amendment type way.
So could a corporation refuse to turn over documents that showed potential evidence against it on the ground that it might incriminate itself?
No. Right now, corporations don't have
They can't do it now. But is there a possibility of the rights of corporations being extended so that it could?
Well, I think that's a big question. I think there's a major question here about whether what the Supreme Court is doing is going amendment by amendment in making a determination as to which rights corporations should have as well as natural persons and which ones corporations would not have or not reasonable for them. And a good example might be Professor Winkler's expertise area, which is the Second Amendment. I mean, are we going to have a situation in which corporations are permitted to arm themselves, for instance, under the Second Amendment, the same way that we're now having a situation in which corporations are permitted to at least vindicate their shareholders' religious rights and religious freedoms? Right now, you know, I think everybody is in agreement that there is no case presently before the court, before the Supreme Court, that brings these issues to light. But the trend is a very interesting trend in terms of giving individual rights to corporations that corporations have not previously had.
How is this inconsistent with the rights granted to natural persons in the instance of the detainees at Guantanamo Bay?
Well, this is a case which my firm, Lewis Bach, and I personally was involved in, which was a case in which we brought a RFRA claim, a claim under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which is the same act that is at issue in the Arkansas prisoner case. And, I'm sorry. Well, it's pretty much the same. It's the analogous right, and also is the right that Hobby Lobby was vindicating, and that is the right to have the least amount of government interference in your ability to exercise your religious beliefs. And we brought a case on behalf of Guantanamo detainees saying that the persons in charge of their incarceration at Guantanamo would deliberately interfere with their ability to practice their religion. They would be interrupted at prayer. They would be not given appropriate clothing for prayer or not given access to washing water for prayer. The Qurans were being desecrated. And it is a classic set of facts that would state a claim under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act and entitle them to relief. And our case, it was determined at the trial court that they, in fact, had those rights and that those rights should be recognized. And then on the Court of Appeals essentially held that Guantanamo detainees are not persons for the purpose of RFRA, for the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, and therefore have no rights under the statute. So we have the quite anomalous situation in which a corporation can be considered to be a person with the rights under the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, even though a corporation would never be bar mitzvahed or engage in any actual religious rites. But a detainee who actually wants to pray and wants to be able to exercise his religious rights is not deemed a person under the statute.
Let me go back to Jonathan Adler at Western Reserve University, Case Western Reserve University. Is that consistent, or do we see a remarkable difference between the rights of corporations and the rights of individuals?
Well, I mean, I do think the court has recognized a difference. In 2011, for example, the court held unanimously that corporations do not have personal privacy for purposes of the Freedom of Information Act. I think where the court has recognized rights in corporations are in those instances in which corporations are essentially the vessels or the mechanisms through which individuals exercise their rights. So that's why we recognize the free speech rights of corporations, whether it's a radio station or a newspaper or a nonprofit like Citizens United or even a for-profit corporation. But it's a reason why we don't, for example, recognize Fifth Amendment rights. I do think on the issue of detainees, I do think that the court's unwillingness to reconsider the constitutional protections that should be provided to detainees, its refusal to do so has been conspicuous. The court in Boumediene issued a very broad, far-reaching opinion suggesting that constitutional protections do apply to alleged enemy combatants. And since then, the court has turned away all of the cert petitions trying to flesh out these questions. All of these cases really go through a single federal court, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit, so you can't get a circuit split. And I think a lot of observers have been scratching their heads, wondering why the court is unwilling to follow up on what had been a very important opinion and help clarify the extent to which the Constitution applies in what's a very important and very unique context.
I take it you would not want to extend Second Amendment rights to corporations?
But I think individuals who work for a corporation, just because they work for a corporation, wouldn't lose that. I think we recognize the property rights of corporations. We allow corporations to own property, and there's no reason why we would, I think, treat that differently depending on the type of property at issue, whether it's something that can be used as a weapon or whether it's a printing press.
Okay, Toomey, what do you say to that?
Well, I mean, I think I would say that individuals who work for corporations, of course, have individual rights. They have Fifth Amendment rights. They have Second Amendment rights and all that. I think that the real shift in the Hobby Lobby case is that there was this idea that the corporation is simply an amalgam of its shareholders and therefore is able to assert their rights. And, of course, the whole purpose of having a corporate form, an artificial person that you create, is that it is, in fact, separate from the shareholders. And the shareholders gain a lot of benefits from that, including limited liability. And so the idea that we can look through the corporation to the shareholders when the shareholders want to vindicate their religious rights, but that we will hold the shareholders as separate when, for instance, a creditor wants to be paid by the corporation and isn't permitted to go to the shareholders is entirely inconsistent with, you know, several hundred years of corporate law.
Let me go back to Dahlia Lithwick, the senior editor at Slate, who covers law and the courts, who was in the courtroom today when the opening arguments, or the first arguments, rather, of this session were heard. Earlier, we talked about Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Adam Winkler, Professor Winkler's suggestion that, as along with others, that she should step down given her age. What's your feeling about that?
I'm in the camp of people who say more power to her. She's 81. She can bench press probably you and me put together, Warren. She's really, I think, in an exquisitely powerful position, at least on the minority wing of the court, insofar as she's the most senior justice. She assigns opinions. She's been writing just extraordinary opinions, whether it's the Shelby County Voting Rights Act case, the Walmart case, the Lilly Ledbetter case, the big, big dissent last year in Hobby Lobby. And I think I would probably link up something Professor Adler said, which is, you know, yes, in many ways, this court has been unanimous on big cases, but where they fracture is on such interesting gender lines. And I think last term was a really emblematic term in terms of all of the women arraying against the Hobby Lobby opinion. And I just think that we are not going to get, probably in our lifetimes, another former ACLU gender lawyer who argued the seminal equal protection for women cases at the Supreme Court. We'll never confirm another. And I think that, and she's said so in so many words, you will not replace me with someone like me in this climate. So my own sense is she is doing probably the most important work of her career at this moment, and that it feels to me beyond unseemly to be pushing her off the court because of her age. I think if we trust her to be a justice, we have to trust her to know when it's time to go.
Kate Toomey, do you agree with that?
Oh, I totally agree with that. I totally agree with that. I mean, I think she's referred to in the popular press as the notorious RBG, is an incredible force for women and has been her entire life. And her work in the 70s and 80s before she was appointed to the D.C. Circuit was phenomenally important in the equal protection area.
Adam Winkler, back to you. What about, though, the prospect of her being replaced by somebody else before she's able to decide all that many more cases?
Well, you know, it doesn't seem like there's going to be any replacement for her anytime soon because she's not stepping down. And if she did step down, I think that there is the added difficulty after this next term about what happens to the Senate in November. If Republicans capture the Senate, it makes it that much less likely that Obama would be able to get someone through the confirmation process like Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And I think she's right that you're not going to get someone just like her, but we're talking about putting a seat in play for the next 30 years. Justices are tend to be appointed now in their 50s, and we can expect whoever replaces her to be on the bench for a very long time. You know, taking a chance that that's going to be someone who's appointed by President Marco Rubio or President Rand Paul is a pretty big gamble, and I hope for Ruth Bader Ginsburg that it works out for her.
Well, it might be a gamble to vote on Rand Paul, or to bet, rather, on Rand Paul or Marco Rubio at this point, too. We'll never know until 2016 exactly what's going to happen there, but it's worth speculating about and fun to do. Thank you all very much for being on our program. Again, Adam Winkler is a constitutional professor at UCLA, author of Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. Kate Toomey is with Louis Bach in Washington. She's represented both corporations and Guantanamo detainees. Jonathan Adler, professor of case of law at Case Western Reserve University, also with the National Review Online and the legal blog The Volokh Conspiracy, and Dahlia Lithwick, senior editor at Slate, covering law and the courts. Thank you very much, all of you, for being on our program today. The Miami Herald published reports of an extramarital affair that scuttled a presidential campaign in 1988. Actually, it was in 1987, before the campaign had actually begun, that the candidate quit. A new book calls that a transformational moment in political journalism, and we'll hear more about the downfall of Democrat Gary Hart in a moment on To the Point.
Have you checked out the KCRW iPad app? It's called The Music Mine. Stream music handpicked by our DJs, watch live performances, and find new music. See why iTunes calls it an essential app for music discovery. Download and learn more at kcrw.com/musicmine.
Warman, I'll be back with today's talking point. Colorado's Democratic U.S. Senator Gary Hart lost his party's presidential nomination in 1984. 3 years later, though, he looked like he'd be a winner. Then the Miami Herald investigated a rumor that turned out to be true, that Hart was having an extramarital affair with a young blonde named Donna Rice. Hart quit the campaign, and he's most often remembered now for the picture of Donna Rice on his lap on the deck of a yacht called Monkey Business. That's the heart of a new book on what Hart's demise meant for political journalism. It's called All the Truth is Out by Matt Bai, who's formerly with the New York Times, now with Yahoo. Great to have you back on our program. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Warren. Great to be here. How you been?
Good. Well, how about you?
I'm great. Thank you. I'm having fun. We're about a week out with the book, and it's been a lot of fun talking about it.
Why is it so important? Why is this a seminal moment in political journalism?
Well, I think it's a seminal moment. If you just look, on the face of it, go back to say, as you know, if you looked at Franklin Roosevelt or John Kennedy or Lyndon Johnson, right? At no time do we really consider does the media really consider, or the voters, personal morality and behaviors to be part of the public integrity of our leaders nationally? And then you flash forward to this moment in 1987, often forgotten, and what's remembered, frankly, is almost entirely wrong. And you have this guy, Gary Hart, who was the Hillary Clinton of his day, the presumed nominee of the Democratic Party, well ahead in head-to-head polls with the vice president at the time, George H.W. Bush. He is literally backed up against a brick wall in an oil-stained alley behind his townhouse by four reporters for the Miami Herald who are peppering him with questions. Who's that woman in your house? Did you have sex with that woman? How can you be a moral leader? Didn't you say you were going to be a moral leader? And in that moment, on that ground, in that alley, I think the boundaries and the rules of politics and political journalism really begin to shift inexorably and bring us really to where we are today. I think it's important to understand that, to understand sort of the modern political culture and the obsession with scandal that has marked so much of my time in political journalism.
Of course, after FDR, after JFK, after LBJ, we had the women's movement, and Hart was reported to be a serial womanizer long before the stories about Donna Rice came along.
Well, it's important to remember a couple of things about Hart, and you're right, the feminism movement has some part in this, as do a lot of social currents. Look, Hart was twice separated from his wife after he arrived in Washington in the 1970s up until, you know, and through the 1980s. One of those times he slept on Bob Woodward's couch, by the way, and nobody wrote about it and nobody cared. He had dated women openly in Washington because he was separated. So a lot of his reputation was gained, you know, during a time when he wasn't breaking marital vows. And it's important to note, you know, even from your intro with Donna Rice, he only saw Donna Rice twice. I don't know if you can call it an affair. I'm not sure what you can call it. But, you know, a lot of this has been, I think, made more of in the aftermath than there really was. But as you say, there were changing attitudes about adultery. There were changing attitudes on the right and the moral majority about moral values and what it meant to leadership. There were changing attitudes about politicians and presidents after Watergate, when people felt suddenly that personal morality was actually a very important part of leadership. We had the birth of satellite television. You had a new generation of journalists who very much wanted to be Woodward and Bernstein, to take someone down, and now you have punditry and you have news coming at you from any place at any minute and every story presented like a soap opera. And you begin to really have this tilt toward a more entertainment-focused media. And I would contend, Warren, that Gary Hart did not fall into this because he was Gary Hart and he did a bunch of stupid things. He fell into it because somebody was going to walk into that moment. All of these forces were churning. It was inevitably going to take this turn deeper into people's personal lives and deeper into sort of the chase of the scandal. And Hart is the guy who walks into it.
In the Los Angeles Times, David Lauder, in a review of your book, points out that Alexander Hamilton had an affair with a married woman that helped to force him from public office. In 1884, he says, the chant of "Ma, Ma, Where's My Pa?" was designed to spread a newspaper story about an illegitimate child of Grover Cleveland. So is this really anything all that new?
It is, Warren. You know, David Lauder, I think, in that review is a bit of an outlier, and he was, I think, sort of rallying to the defense of that generation of journalists. But, you know, the truth is the media in the 1800s wasn't anything like the media as we think of it today. It was really a group of partisan organizations bent on destroying the other side. I mean, you also had a congressman getting caned on the House floor. I don't know that that's the standard we really want to be adhering to. I think it makes a lot more sense. It's a lot more relevant for people to understand to talk about the 20th century. And in the context of the 20th century, it was a serious moment of departure. So you can reach back to, if you need to, you could go back to Cleveland and Hamilton to try to make the case that this was not all that big a deal. But I don't think for any practical discussion of the issues that has any relevance.
Is it a good thing, or was it a good thing, when political reporters became credible because they got to be good friends with the candidates or the office holders involved? And is that better than having them stand back and be critical of the candidates, even down to and including their personal behavior?
Well, I think that's a critical question, Warren. I think it's a question readers have to grapple with. It's a question I grapple with as someone who's covered four presidential campaigns and been in this business a while now, because you can't be nostalgic about it and say, oh, it was all great in the old days when they all hang around together. There were things going on in John Kennedy's personal life we probably would have been better served to know. There was protection of reporters, and there was manipulation of politicians and manipulation of reporters that went on. So, you know, I don't think that's all good, but I do think that we overcompensated in the beginning in 1987 and really in the wake of Watergate. And I think, you know, the guiding ethos of political journalism, and I think voters and readers understand this very well, really shifted from an illumination of worldviews and ideas and agendas for candidates to this notion of, we know you're lying about something. Our goal is to find out what it is. Our prime directive is to expose the flaw. And it really did create a shallower conversation, because when politicians can't express anything with any nuance or complexity, and they sort of they withdraw in fear from that process, and then what you get are a lot of politicians who can glide through the process without having any ideas or knowledge, because they seem no different than the other candidates. They're not called upon to explain themselves at all. And I think it has led to a much less ennobling and much less illuminating kind of politics for people, and they're frustrated.
You talk in detail in a wonderfully reported book about some of the jokes that were made about Gary Hart, about Johnny Carson saying that the nomination would fall into Hart's lap if there were any room left there. A reference, obviously, to the picture on the boat. And in Golden Girls, one of the little old ladies said, she's Gary Hart's campaign manager. It doesn't pay much, but you don't have to get out of bed to do it. To what extent do people get their political views from sources like that? And do they still today?
Well, I think they do today, but in the context of 1987, what's so important to remember, as you and I do, is that the media wasn't yet fractured, right? We didn't yet have what we call, you know, niche markets. There was only a handful of networks, a handful of national papers, and Johnny Carson commanded a platform unlike any forum we have today. So people may read that and think, well, Jon Stewart does that all the time, but when Johnny Carson made fun of you for a couple of nights running in a monologue, you were a national joke, and you did not escape that. I mean, part of, for me, the compelling reason to tell this story, because as you know, the book really is, it's less a polemic, it's really a story, it's a narrative, and part of what's so compelling to me about this story is this man who could see around corners and was really one of the visionary politicians of his time, and ends up disgraced and in this place that you're describing, and has to live with that and has to go through. I follow him, you know, there's a chapter in the book just following him through the years afterward and how he processes that portrayal of himself and tries to get back into public service and lives with the guilt of letting people down and the frustration of never being able to escape it. And I think whether whether it's politics or sports or, you know, whatever you care about, if you care about human stories, I think it's just a very compelling tragic story that I think people can relate to, and I certainly could relate to, and one of the things that drew me to tell it.
And that's one of the reasons we wanted to talk about it on our program. It's a wonderfully compelling book, and for those who are interested, part of it involves Gary Hart happily at home with his wife. Matt Bai with the book All the Truth Is Out, The Week Politics Went Tabloid. Thanks so much for being on our program.
Oh, thanks for having me, Warren. It's always fun.
I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast. It's a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.